What does the Duke lacrosse scandal tell us about the American university system today? William D. Cohen will be here to talk about the price of silence, the Duke lacrosse scandal, the power of the elite, and the corruption of our great universities.
They think they're doing the Lord's work one day, and the next day, you know, they're dealing with a major scandal.
Is Elizabeth Warren's new memoir a campaign book or something else? Amy Chozek will join us to talk about her review of A Fighting Chance.
She has said she's not running for president. She continues to say that she's focused on her job in the Senate right now, but that hasn't stopped this very vocal wing of the Democratic Party.
Parul Sehgal joins us to talk about her review of Barbara Ehrenreich's new memoir, Living with a Wild God.
Is there a way that an atheist can talk about experiencing the world or experiencing some sort of phenomenon and not saying that this is a god?
My colleagues John Williams and Parul Sehgal will join me to talk about this week in the book business. And Greg Coles will have bestseller news. This is Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Pamela Paul. William D. Cohen joins us now to talk about his new book, The Price of Silence, The Duke Lacrosse Scandal, The Power of the Elite, and the Corruption of Our Great Universities, reviewed this week by Caitlin Flanagan. Hi, William.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be
here. Thanks for coming. For those people who did not read the hundreds and hundreds of headlines in 2006 about the scandal, tell us what happened.
So basically, it's one of those incredible stories where this lacrosse team at Duke is there on spring break. Everybody else is away from campus. Been a spring break tradition for them to have a party. So they had an all-day party, lots of drinking, including underage drinking. And then they had the bright idea at about during the party to invite two strippers later that night to come and perform for them for 2 hours. They're going to pay them $400 each. They wanted white strippers. They ended up with two black strippers. One thing led to another. Situation got totally out of control. After about 5 minutes, the dancing stopped. Eventually, one of the dancers, a woman named Crystal Mangum, accused three of the lacrosse players of raping, sexually assaulting, and kidnapping her.
And then what happened?
Well, aside from all hell breaking loose, for the next, so that was in March of 2006, and basically until April of 2007, Duke was in a conflagration, the campus. Duke and Durham were in a conflagration. The justice system in North Carolina kicked in. Three of the players were indicted for those crimes. Which is one of the more fascinating things about this case, and is never, I can't really think of another case in jurisprudence history where the defense attorneys were able to very skillfully turn the whole case around. And where there had originally been a rush to judgment to condemn these three players, the whole thing, the whole narrative got turned around, and there was a rush to judgment to condemn Crystal Mangum, the victim who later became known as the accuser, and Mike Nifong, the Durham district attorney who was trying to prosecute the case. Eventually, the state bar filed charges against Mike Nifong. He felt he needed to recuse himself to deal with those charges. He was later disbarred, fired, spent a day in jail for contempt of court, filed for personal bankruptcy. The case was turned over by Nifong to Roy Cooper, the state attorney general in North Carolina, who's still there to this day. He did a four-month secret investigation, declared the three men, innocent, which is not a word that's used in jurisprudence. Usually people are either guilty or not guilty. There was no trial. Then eventually the three players got a $20 million settlement each from Duke. The party cost Duke $100 million, and we're still dealing with the aftermath of it.
Wow. I mean, there are many steps along the way where what you think would happen happened, even if it's appalling, the victim turning into, you know, then having herself become the focus of investigation. But let's talk about this, the word innocence. I mean, what actually, do we know what did happen?
No, we'll never know what happened because there was no trial. There was no evidence put on in a trial that both sides could react to. I start the book with a quote from Errol Morris, the gist of which is, the truth is out there. If in theory and principle, we can find the truth. And so that was sort of my guiding light. I'm a Duke grad. I wanted to know what happened. I've written three previous books about Wall Street. That would have been the easiest thing for me to do is to stay in
LA.
That
was my next question.
Yeah.
Yes, because you're a former investment banker, right? You did a book on Lazard, a book on Goldman.
And a book on the collapse of Bear Stearns. And so, you know, but this was a sort of, you can call it my Michael Lewis moment or whatever, where I wanted to move away from Wall Street and cover this incredible story. And the more I learned about it, the more incredible it got. And the passions about it were acute during the case and remain acute to this day. You had a situation where we'll never know what happened because of the fact there was no trial. It's sort of one of those things, as Donald Rumsfeld said in Errol Morris's new film. I mean, it's sort of like a known unknown. We know that we will never know what happened in that bathroom unless Roy Cooper, who is the Attorney General of State of North Carolina,
who did that long secret investigation,
who did the secret investigation, declared them innocent, who declined my kind invitations to be interviewed, and has also declined to make public his investigation. Now I've sued him in North Carolina court to try to make that public.
I was going to say that must be incredibly frustrating, and obviously it was, to not have him speak with you.
I don't have subpoena power.
Yeah.
I faithfully represented his point of view because he did put out a 20-page summary of his findings,
mm-hmm.
Wherein he declared them innocent and where he decided, interestingly, not to prosecute Crystal Mangum for making false charges, even though he believed that she did, which is a very odd decision. He also basically said Mike Nifong was a rogue prosecutor. You know, it's a very curious turn of events. I don't think I can think of a single other example where a sitting district attorney was unable to bring a case that he believed he had the evidence to prove what happened in court. You know, I think he was prepared to lose that case. He'd lost others. I mean, he'd been in the district attorney's office for 28 years. He was not a neophyte. He was a very well-regarded prosecutor. But suddenly, the defense crafted this unbelievable narrative that portrayed him as completely rogue, completely off the reservation, and they are still going after Mike Nifong to this day, which is fascinating.
Let's step back. 2006, you're reading all these headlines. You're a Duke alum. What did you think? Do you remember your own thinking, your reaction to the case as it moved from step to step? And did your own thinking change during that time?
Well, of course. I mean,
yes.
You know, I was up here in New York while I'm a loyal Duke alum. I first, of course, like everybody, we're all sort of persuaded, unless we're intimately involved, by what's reported on these matters. And so I first thought the kids had to be guilty, like everybody else. And by the way, as a Duke grad, and knowing sort of the work hard, play hard culture down there, you know, it didn't strike me as implausible, just like it didn't strike many Duke alums as implausible. I mean, regrettable and horrible in every way, but not surprising. And so that's what we first believed. And then, I mean, when it was completely virulent condemnation of what had happened in these kids. I mean, it was all over. You know, it was the Bridgegate and the Flight 370 of our day.
Right.
And then, of course, the whole narrative got completely turned around, and I honestly did not know what to believe. And when they were declared innocent, I didn't know any different. But I decided soon thereafter that I wanted to take a deep look at this story in a very dispassionate way. I figured 7 years after it had occurred was a good time to collect all the documents that had been available, because there's been numerous lawsuits where documents had been made available that were never available at the time. People would talk to me who had never spoken before, like Mike Nifong and Crystal Mangum and Bob Steele and others and some of the players. And so it just made for me, I mean, the story itself is so incredible and so compelling. You think you're just, you know, going to have this party, which is like an occurrence on college campuses virtually every day of the week, right? Underage drinking is an epidemic. Binge drinking is an epidemic. We know that. And you think you're just having that kind of a party with your buddies. And the next thing you know, you're being accused of raping a stripper. And your whole life is changed. And the life of the 47 kids on that team basically was changed.
Let's talk just a second about Duke, because it's such an interesting school. I mean, you have, on the one hand, you have these Ivy League level academics. It's a Southern school, very much Southern school, even though it's part of that, you know, little the research triangle in North Carolina. And sports, obviously, huge part of the school. And race, because it's in the South, is obviously
Durham, which is 45% black.
What did the whole scandal tell you about Duke specifically? And as an alum, how did it make you feel?
Well, obviously, as somebody who spent 4 years there and has been close to it ever since I left in 1981, I continue to serve on two lower level boards there. So, I mean, I was aware of this whole ethic at Duke of sort of work hard, play hard, sort of the rowdy. I mean, Duke has a reputation of being very strong academically and intellectually, and also being a place where you can have a lot of fun.
Did this change the way you feel about the school now?
Yes and no. No, because I'm a loyal Duke alum, and while it was a shocker and an eye-opener, I was disappointed that Dick Broadhead wouldn't talk to me. Mm-hmm. I thought that Duke would stand for academic and intellectual and press freedom.
Transparency.
No. And what really shocked me, even though he's one of my strongest critics by far, is what they did to Casey Johnson, who is a blogger who along with Stuart Taylor, wrote a book about all this in 2007, a very biased book, but nevertheless, they wrote a book. And what Duke did, because there were these lawsuits brought by the players against the university, and he had been very close to the players and their families, they sued Casey Johnson, who's mm-hmm. a blogger and a Brooklyn law professor. They sued him in court in Maine to try to get access to his records and his interviews and his transcripts and his notes. And I thought that was really quite stunning, that my alma mater would go after, a working sort of blogger slash professor. I don't know whether he's technically a journalist, but to go after and get his notes and records from the interviews he'd had with players and their families, and to try to discredit him and to try to win their lawsuit. Eventually, that lawsuit was settled, and even though Casey Johnson lost a few rounds in court in Maine, it was very disturbing to find out about that.
What's the university's reaction been to your book so far?
Silence.
The price of silence. Very maybe appropriate. Wow.
Duke is, my last book was about Goldman Sachs. I mean, I got more cooperation from Goldman Sachs in writing my book than from Duke in writing this book, which shows that these universities are really no different than corporations, and that they are, heavily influenced by lawyers who give them advice.
Yes. The book is not really just about this scandal, though, and I think that's something that Caitlin Flanagan points out in our review, and it's in your subtitle, The Duke Lacrosse Scandal, The Power of the Elite and the Corruption of Our Great Universities. It's a big book and a big subject. It's not just about the sports scandal. What was your larger point?
The larger point is something that Elizabeth Warren has been saying lately, is the ability of power and money, and she's talking about to corrupt the behavior in Washington. I mean, clearly this is a story about the ability of money and power to corrupt this university, other universities. We all know that exceptions are made for athletes. We can read about this every day. I mean, the Times had a huge story about the quarterback at Florida State, and really gets you to scratch your head about what the heck happened there. Was an exception made for him? The internet is now filled in the last few days with a scandal at American University, where these horrible emails are out there talking about what may or may not have happened at a frat there. And I include in the back of the book, 10 or 15 different examples of sexual assaults that had happened on campus or frat-related deaths, that just shows how, in fact, money and power can corrupt the behavior at these universities, the corrosive, incredibly corrosive effect of underage drinking and binge drinking has on campus. And this is, of course, a problem at every single campus, with the drinking age being 21. Basically, you're forcing administrators to just turn a blind eye to all of this. And there's a reason that President Obama in January created a task force among his cabinet to focus on sexual assaults on campus. This is a true epidemic. And this story at Duke, just shows the thin blue line that exists for any campus, any a university administration. They think they're doing the Lord's work one day, and the next day, you know, they're dealing with a major scandal.
All right, William Cohen, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
The book, again, is The Price of Silence, The Duke Lacrosse Scandal, The Power of the Elite, and the Corruption of Our Great Universities, reviewed this week in the book review by Caitlin Flanagan. John Williams and Parul Sehgal from the Book Review join me now to talk about what's going on in the book business this week. Hi, Parul.
Hi, Pamela.
Hi, John. So let's talk a little bit about our cover review subject this week. We reviewed Joe Becker's new book, Forcing the Spring, and the book itself has been making a lot of headlines. What has been going on? What's the issue?
It seemed to have started when Andrew Sullivan posted something on his blog, sort of saying that, Becker had inflated the importance of this particular case, this case being the Hollingsworth versus Perry, which sort of maintained the unconstitutionality of Prop 8.
So the issue is gay marriage.
Right, gay marriage. And it's sort of, you know, focused on the characters that she could have access to, David Boyce, and then there's the head of the HRC.
Chad Griffin.
Writing out people that had been involved for the last, 25 years, and who'd laid a lot of the intellectual groundwork, including him, he says, in his book. So it seems to be snowballing, Dan Savage has sort of made similar criticisms, Frank Rich has been saying certain things, and it all seems to center around her wording. At one point, she says that the revolution started in 2008, I'm paraphrasing, when these particular players got involved, and so what Sullivan, Frank Rich, Dan Savage, and a lot of these people are saying is that this has been going on for a very long time, that you cannot write out so many important people and so many important cases that were happening, especially the United States versus Windsor, which gets about 30 pages in a 400-page book, which is what Linda Hirschman on the cover, makes a similar point.
I think, Becker's defense is that she was writing about this particular case and the sort of drive to bring the issue of gay marriage to the Supreme Court, which was a new tactic. And, and there are people who have written more positive reviews of the book who say, for instance, Connie Schultz in The Washington Post said, this book is not intended to be a tome on gay history, but Becker should brace for accusations of omission. I hope she did, because they're certainly coming.
The review, we should say, got a very positive review on our cover by Linda Hirschman, who's the author of Victory, a book on the gay movement overall.
I mean, it has gotten some positive reviews, and I think that people have said that the access she got certainly makes it an internal look at a very big issue, and there's some gripping sort of legal details and things like that. But I think because there are so many activists in this issue that have been working for so long, they sort of feel like they were ignored, and so they they're making that loudly known online.
I mean, interestingly, this happened back when Randy Schultz wrote "And the Band Played On," mm-hmm. where a lot of people said, "Hey, you're overlooking a lot of other on the ground people." And
right, and Chad Griffin himself, who is the person who he's a political operative who sort of got heavily involved in this. Ted Olson and David Boyce were bringing the case on his behalf. And he just recently, in the last day or so, wrote online a long essay about sort of some of the people who have come before and why, we should obviously honor those people. And, some people are saying that's too little, too late. Other people, like Sullivan, just today on his blog said that it was graceful and, that even though it's also a little too late, that we should just put this beside and work forward to getting the issue solved.
I mean, doesn't a lot of this come down to kind of the mechanics of book writing and how you conceive of telling a story, whether you are going to, tell a huge sweeping history or whether you're going to limit your narrative to a particular court case or a particular story?
And Becker, what she did was she embedded herself in this case and with these individuals for 4 years, and she tells a very particular story, and it's very, it's a courtroom drama in certain places and a very blow-by-blow account. So this was the story that she wanted to tell. But I think, this is an issue that keeps being raised when the history of movements is written, right? Who is written in, who is written out, who is deemed palatable, who is deemed important? Why do we know about, for example, like Harvey Milk and not Sylvia Rivera? Why do we know about Gandhi, not Bhagat Singh? So
right.
This is always something that will be part of the tensions around these official narratives.
I think also that there is a way in which she genuinely wasn't, I think she starts the book with some language that's fairly
expansive
yeah. and applying it mainly to this case, which I think is what rubbed people the wrong way. And I think if she could go back, even though she told Terry Gross in a recent interview that she would word it the same way, I think that there would probably be a more contextual introduction if she were to rewrite the book after all of this criticism. But that's not for us to say.
Now, the other big story, although not really a story, of course, that's dominated literary headlines this week was the death of Gabriel Garcia Marquez. And it's been kind of amazing, the outpouring. I mean, deserve it, of course. But there's been some incredible writing in the wake of his death.
Yeah, a lot of people reacted online and elsewhere. And we have actually up online now an essay by Salman Rushdie that he wrote for the Book Review that will be in print in a couple of weeks, but is now available on the website, in which he really makes a great extended case for why Marquez was obviously not just great because everyone's saying that, but he makes a really interesting case about how his magical realism was very much rooted in sort of true facts. And he contrasts that with what he calls today's places where vampires and zombies prowl, and how, you know, Marquez, he puts it that he used imagination to enrich reality, not to escape from it. And I think it's a really nice piece if people want to go find that.
It's interesting because I think that Garcia Marquez was one of those authors that a lot of people, it's one of the first and most formative big literary works, especially international literary works that people read and feel very strongly about, their first encounter with Love in the Time of Cholera or 100 Years of Solitude.
Yeah, he was beloved. And I really think that, you know, looking at the literary landscape today, who is beloved in this way, not just acclaimed and written about and influential? I think maybe Toni Morrison. I'm trying to think who other people, and it's almost like an imprinting that you're talking about, right?
Yes.
That first moment when you see those butterflies in Remedios the Beauty from 100 Years of Solitude. You've never seen anything like this. And I think it's deeply personal, but I think it also had really, really big ramifications because you look at the writers that wrote in his wake, Rushdie, Ben Okri, Edwidge Danticat, several of whom have written about Garcia Marquez.
Danticat wrote in The New Yorker.
Right, she wrote something in the Page Turner blog, and then she made a point that Rushdie has always made, that this isn't fantastic fiction, not for some of us who come from, you know, places where fables and reality are so mingled, and, you know, we come from like places as Garcia Marquez did, with ludicrous politicians, ludicrous regimes, right? So how do you define what's, you know, realistic in that context?
I do think that it leaves a very deep impression on people of, you know, of the generations that have come after him, because you sort of, you leave behind childhood reading that's deeply imaginative, and you get introduced to things that maybe in high school feel a little dull if you're not, you know, very advanced, and you know that they're, you know, they're important, but you don't quite get caught up in them. Right. And then, you know, when you encounter something like 100 Years of Solitude, there's this incredible combination of the depth of the writing and the adult sort of tone, but the imaginative details. And it's just kind of stunning that this could they could coexist like that.
Yeah. All right. Well, gone, but very much not forgotten. Parul Segal, John Williams, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Amy Chozick, a national political correspondent for The Times, joins us now to talk about Elizabeth Warren's new book, A Fighting Chance. Hi, Amy.
Hi.
So is this a memoir? Is it a campaign book? What exactly is this book about?
Well, it's a bit of a mix. It's a mix of personal story and policy. And it's a very potent mix that people have said, well, is this a campaign book? Because it's usually the type of book that a politician puts out when they're contemplating a run for office.
And what's the contemplation? What's the speculation around Elizabeth Warren?
There's been a lot of speculation around Elizabeth Warren in the kind of the left wing of the Democratic Party, the progressive wing, that wants someone who is less of a centrist than Hillary Clinton. And they've really been pushing for Elizabeth Warren. She has said she's not running for president. She continues to say that she's focused on her job in the Senate right now. But that hasn't stopped this very vocal wing of the Democratic Party.
And she's still in her first term in the Senate.
Exactly. Of course, we have had a first term senator as president.
Right. There has been a precedent.
Yeah.
This is not her first book, though. She's written academic books. And how is this different from sort of the kind of thing that she's done before? Does it feel different?
Well, it's really interesting to look at her earlier books. I mean, the book that really catapults her to fame was a book about the middle class struggling with bankruptcy that she co-wrote with her daughter. And in that book, she is
The Two Income Trap.
Yes, thank you. The Two Income Trap, I think, came out around 2004. And that was, in that book, she's a lot less cautious. She's very critical of Hillary Clinton. She says that she supported her efforts at protecting families from bankruptcy when she was first lady. But then Elizabeth Warren says that Senator Clinton of New York kind of was much more friendly towards the banks after she was a New York senator who relied on Wall Street for support.
Were there any big surprises in the book? The book is embargoed, as so many political books are these days, meaning that, you know, it's sort of a lay down date where people can, you know, finally get it in their bookstore or online. Are there any big revelations in the book?
To me, the revelation was that Elizabeth Warren is often caricatured as this kind of lefty Massachusetts senator, you know, who hates the banks. And to me, the surprise was just how personal it was and how compelling her personal story is. She writes a lot about growing up in Oklahoma, very middle class, you know, watching her mother kind of try to pull on this black dress that doesn't fit her anymore just so she can go interview for a job at Sears and Roebuck to help the family keep their house. There's a lot of personal moments that for me as a political reporter, I just hadn't heard her talk about in depth.
And in terms of her anti-bank reputation, or I mean, did that come through? Does she come through as very left-wing, or is it more moderate, or is it a mix?
I think she's very savvy because she is very fiery, her typical fiery rhetoric about the banks. You know, she lives in a very polarized world. There are banks bad, working people good, and being exploited. There is no gray area in Elizabeth Warren's worldview about banks. And so people who agree with that narrative will get all riled up about this book. People who disagree will, you know, could make their skin crawl.
There's fodder for the haters.
Absolutely.
And now, of course, Warren was an academic before she entered politics, and earlier books that she's written have been more academic in nature. Does this feel like an academic book? Did it feel wonky, or is it relatively accessible?
It does not feel that academic. There are wonky parts. She goes into excruciating detail about the formation of a consumer protection agency, which was kind of her idea of a way to protect consumers from the fine print on your credit cards and mortgages. And that part gets a little wonky. And in a way, it did feel like you're sitting down with your favorite professor. You know, it wasn't so academic and wonky, but it did feel like she wanted to teach you something based on her life experiences.
And you mentioned the anecdote about her mother trying to get into an interview dress for a job at Sears Roebuck. Were there other moments that struck you as particularly interesting in the book?
I always think reading a female politician's book is an interesting thing. How much are you going to go into gender? How much is this going to be, you know, lean in for the political set? And
right.
She was very interesting. She talked about being married, her first marriage, and she was trying to go to law school and then be a young law professor and also raise two kids. And this was the 70s when she was really just expected to put food on the table. And she has this very intimate moment when she just looks over to her husband. She's exhausted. She's cooking. She's putting the kids to bed. Her husband is just smoking a cigarette in the kitchen waiting for his dinner. And she just looks over and says, "Would you like a divorce?" And he says, "No."
With your peace.
Exactly. "Would you like a side of divorce with that?" He says, "No." She writes, "No hesitation, just yes." He moved out the next week.
Wow. This is her first. She's written four books before this, with co-authors. And this one, at least, there's no second author credited. Did you get a sense of her voice in the book? Does it feel like the way she sounds on TV, the way that you've heard her speak in person?
Yes, I did. I thought her voice was really interesting in this book because obviously on TV she's trained, she has her talking points, she sticks to them. At least now that she's a senator, she very much sticks to her talking points. Her voice is really folksy. I write in the review it's more Nick at Night than The Nation. You know, she's like, "Golly wow, we got this consumer protection agency." As she talks about imitating the Three Stooges before her and Obama walked into the Rose Garden. And so I was surprised at just kind of how goofy her voice is.
Yeah.
But it makes it likable.
Now, in your other life here at the paper, you have done a lot of reporting on business, but have been reporting on the Clinton family for the last year. Is it about a year now?
Yeah.
And how did you see this book sort of fitting into your overall kind of your Clinton reporting? And does it feel like Warren has become a significant figure? And when we talk about Hillary and what's coming up in the next election.
Yeah, I think absolutely. I think when you're looking at 2016, nobody is discounting Elizabeth Warren. Not necessarily that she's going to run. She said she isn't. But her policies have really excited part of the Democratic base who says we need an alternative to Hillary Clinton who is a little bit more left on these financial regulation issues. We don't really know Elizabeth Warren's policies on overseas foreign policy, but that would also be something that the left wing of the party is looking for, someone who's maybe less of a hawk than Hillary Clinton. And so I think just Elizabeth Warren kind of swooping around has had a lot of people in the party wonder, you know, are we going to have that debate about what Democrats stand for and who is going to represent the left side of the party in that debate? If not Elizabeth Warren, who?
So I imagine we'll be hearing more from you on this. Amy Chozick, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
That was Amy Chozick. This week, she reviews Elizabeth Warren's new book in the Book Review, A Fighting Chance. Carl Sagal, an editor at the Book Review, joins us now to talk about her review this week of Barbara Ehrenreich's new book, Living with a Wild God. Hi, Carl.
Hi, Pamela.
So this is a very different book for Barbara Ehrenreich. She is known for Nickel and Dimed and
Bright-sided, these very sort of hard-hitting, investigative, skeptical books. It's a different book for her, and it's also one of the most surprising memoirs I think I've ever read. To hear that Barbara Ehrenreich is writing a memoir, I think people would expect, you know, something about her politicization, you know, her work as a writer. She was trained as a scientist. But instead, she gives us this book about these suppressed mystical visions that she started having in her teens and told nobody about, but wrote about in her journal.
I mean, yeah, it's surprising that it's a memoir. And it's surprising that given that Ehrenreich is a
staunch atheist.
The subtitle is A Non-Believer's Search for the Truth About Everything. So what happened to her as a teenager?
When she was about, I think they started in her mid-teens. And one day she was outside with her family and she saw the trees walk out of the forest towards her. And she was completely rattled. She was completely frightened because at that point she'd already started becoming the custodian of her mind in this very interesting way. She was already deeply interested in science. She was deeply interested in rationality. And again, you know, not only was she an atheist, but she came from this long line of what she describes as like very proud working class atheists in America.
As opposed to the lolling rich elite atheists or the impoverished ones.
Yeah, okay. So she was completely terrified and frightened. And then it happened again, and the book really centers around the second time it happened when she was 17 and up on the mountains with some friends, and she walked into a little tiny town early in the morning. She hadn't slept and she hadn't eaten, and suddenly the way she describes it, the world poured into her and I poured into it, that there was no sort of distinction between her and the world.
Okay, so let's, taking a skeptical view of these,
which she does,
of these visions, yeah. I mean, why weren't they just, you know, little flights of imagination, little moments of, I don't know, drug flashback or, something psychological?
That's the spine of the book, that she looks at every possible explanation she can find. It could have been low blood sugar. She could have been really tired. It could have just been sort of, you know, for a while she thought she might have had like a schizophrenic episode. She really does try to look at every possible normal explanation. And she's very embarrassed as she's writing this book too, which sort of gives it a very interesting tone. She's exasperated and she doesn't want to believe that she saw something. But finally, and in a very grudging way, she starts talking about, is there a way that an atheist can talk about experiencing the world or experiencing some sort of phenomenon and not saying that this is a god or one figure.
Right. But I mean, so many atheists are allergic not only to, you know, the concept of anything religious, but also to anything spiritual, which I mean, it's almost a greater evil, in the skeptic's eyes. So does she use that word? Is that how she ultimately sees it?
Oh, she is so funny when she starts sort of trying to decide. And that's such a good question because she tries to figure out the right word. And eventually she sort of settles on presence with a capital P. I mean, it took her a very long time and she moved down to Florida and she started spending a lot of time outside and a lot of time kayaking and sort of experiencing natural phenomenon and letting herself be moved by it. So she starts saying that perhaps that is enough, that there's something there that moves me.
But presence Of what?
It's still very cagey. She sort of circles around. She's first of all, she cancels everything that it isn't going to be for her.
The process of elimination.
That's right. And then finally, there's some other, she says, that there's some other energy. There is some other force there. You know, part of the book is not only naming it, but sort of allowing herself to enjoy it, to not have that sense of shame. The shame is interesting, right? Because we see memoirs about everything. People write really sort of preening memoirs about drugs and incest and every last thing. And I don't think I've ever read such an embarrassed memoir that's so saturated with shame. And part of it, she writes, you know, when you talk about having a mystical vision, you know, people act as if you've been discussing that you've been abducted by aliens.
Right.
You seem a little nutty.
Is that the term that she uses throughout the book, ultimately, a mystical vision?
She does, but like, again, with almost like, you know, you can feel her hackles rise. You know, the entire language of the thing is so offensive to her, but
I don't want to give away the ending entirely, and maybe I shouldn't ask the question, but I will. What does she find in this search for the truth about everything?
I mean, I don't think it would be, it's like a spoiler to say that she does sort of, she doesn't find so much as she's just sort of like contextualizes what she saw into a literature from Dostoevsky on, people experiencing these sorts of things, that there is a vocabulary, that even other people experience these sorts of things. Mm-hmm. And she allows herself to acknowledge that, even though she's never entirely comfortable with it.
So if here's this thing that's totally embarrassing to her, that she's clearly writing about with shame, mm-hmm. and as you said, embarrassment. So you would think she would be reluctant to write about it,
yeah.
Which then leads to the obvious question, why write about it?
I don't know. I mean, and it's so many, I'm leaving out so much of what this book is about right now, because a large part of it is just about her childhood and about growing up with enormously chaotic, broken parents, and also how, like, a child growing up in that household, you know, is her understanding. She's both hurt by it, but then she also feels like she grew so much because of it.
Yes.
You know, with this sort of, within that chaos, she found such permission to be out in the world, to be brave, to be physically adventurous. Her parents didn't care. At one point, there's a hurricane outside of her house. She asks her mom, can I go wander around in it? Her mother's like, sure. So, I mean, there's part of it, like, there is that mystical side of this book, but then there's also certain sort of, like, trappings of a conventional memoir. So I think that she must have been a little shy about writing the memoir,
right.
A little reluctant. So it becomes,
yes.
Like, because this is the kind of book she writes. She writes to get to the truth of things, and this must have been a mystery she can investigate. These are the skills she has.
You know, Barbara Ehrenreich, you strikes me as someone who seems to have a very strong self-conception.
Right.
I mean, she is a scientist. She is an atheist. She has defined politics.
Yeah. She wants you to know this.
A bit of a contrarian. And she's also very, very funny. And mm-hmm. I'm curious mm-hmm. if the book is funny. But it's... strikes me, too, that she's someone who doesn't want to write a memoir. Did you feel like this was her way of
yeah.
writing that memoir?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, I think this is the way that she was comfortable doing it. And again, like, you know, as a journalist, she had to be investigating something. It couldn't just be I'm recounting this. And part of, like, she does want you to know in the book that I'm not the kind of person who would write a memoir. I'm not indulgent in
yes.
this way.
She's, you know, she's a very serious person,
yeah.
but she's also incredibly funny. I mean, when you go back and you read her political writing, you know, in the 80s and 90s, you know, and going on, I mean, she also takes on very serious subjects, but she's very funny. Is this book funny?
She's so funny, and it's very, very grim humor, but... I have always found that she, her biggest target for me in all of her writing, she's completely allergic to any kind of self-pity. So she does this thing where she gives you this story about her parents, and they're coming through the door, they're stumbling through the door, they're bleeding from one of their many drunk driving accidents, and then, you know, one tragedy after another tragedy, and then she goes, you know, but if you think that this is like a normal story of like childhood sadness, I'm doing a bad job of describing it. So she has this... and you can see where she gets some of her tartness.
Mm-hmm.
And it came from this background. And it came from, you know, not only surviving some of the things that she did, but some of the people in her life. You know, she has one story of, I think it was her grandmother who was dying. And her grandmother was like a very proud atheist. And somebody summoned a priest. And the priest tried to put like a cross on her chest. And the grandmother like flinched at the last minute. Her last action was to fling it across the room. So there is some of that bristling, fierce funniness in this book.
All right. Well, it sounds like it's very much a departure, but still Barbara Ehrenreich in her new memoir, Living with a Wild God. Parle Sagel, thank you so much.
Thanks, Pamela.
Greg Coles is here with Bestseller News. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Pamela.
What's new on the list this week?
There are just two new titles on the hardcover fiction list this week. Down at number 15, Gabriel Zevin, who is probably most famous for a young adult novel she wrote called Elsewhere some years ago, has a new novel for adults called The Storied Life of A.J. Fickrey, which is about a bookseller on a remote island whose life has not been going well and is about to get better. And then the other new title is all the way up at the top of the list. The old standby Nora Roberts is back with a new book called The Collector, about a woman, a house sitter, who may have witnessed a murder-suicide. And so it's kind of a suspense romance. She gets involved with one of the victim's brothers.
And nonfiction?
On the nonfiction side of things, there are also just two new titles. At number 8, the journalists Kathy Kay and Claire Shipman have a book called Confidence Code, sort of along the same lines as Sheryl Sandberg's Lean In. But it presents itself as kind of an alternative to Lean In. The publicity material says they don't just ask women to lean in. It's what they actually do. They posit that lack of confidence explains the gender gap in business leadership, and they offer ways that women might be able to nurture confidence. They interview business leaders. They talk about their own lives. They look at kind of the neuroscience of confidence. They say, you know, nurture true confidence, not kind of a bravado, but it involves a willingness to take risks and to learn from failure and to trust your instincts, to cultivate competence that way. Competence and confidence.
I already knew all of that.
Well, you're a woman in a leadership position. And finally, the other new title on the nonfiction list is a book called Players First. It is by the University of Kentucky men's basketball coach John Calipari, written with the sports writer Michael Sokolov. Calipari has been at Kentucky since 2009, and in those 4 years, he's been to the Final Four, the NCAA Final Four, three times. He's won the championship once. He was formerly the coach of the Brooklyn Nets back when they were the New Jersey Nets, after they were the New York Nets, before they were the Brooklyn Nets. So he's got some pro experience, too. But at Kentucky, the big challenge he's faced is this whole one-and-done thing. How much do you know about college basketball?
Oh, you're putting me on the spot. That's one thing I'm not confident about. Tell us.
One-and-done is, it's become very common for players who maybe used to enter the NBA right out of high school. Thanks to some changes in the NBA, that they need college experience to kind of hone their game. And they come in to Kentucky often. Calipari is an excellent recruiter, and he gets some of the nation's top high school players. They come in, they play for just a year, and then they go into the NBA draft. In 2012, after he won the championship that year, he actually had his top six players all drafted away from him in the first round of the NBA draft. And if you know anything about basketball, you know that there are only five starters on each team. So he actually had a player who wasn't even good enough to start for him, who was still a first-round draft pick for the NBA.
Well, in a very nurturing and confident voice, I will let you know that I did not know any of that. So thank you very much for filling me in. Thanks,
sure.
Greg.
You're very welcome, Pamela.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. Thanks for listening. For the New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.